Welcome to the Conservative Thought Hour, where America always comes first.
I'm proud to be an American.
Each week, we bring you captivating guests who will speak on many topics of national interest. We are not interested in telling you what to think or how to think. We have faith that you can do that for yourself. Our interest is to bring you information to help you form your own opinions. As always, the views expressed by our guests are their own and are not necessarily shared by the host or the station you are listening to. Get ready for enlightenment with the Conservative Thought Hour.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
And now, here are your hosts, Carrie Black and Rick Stannard.
Good morning. I'm your host, Rick Stannard, along with Carrie Black, who's on vacation this week. We have a great hour ahead with our guest, Jason Kilmeyer. Thanks for being here, Jason.
Rick, thanks for having me.
All right. Now, you have an incredibly interesting background. I'm going to read a little of your bio. You're a counterterrorism expert and foreign policy expert specializing in emergency technology applications. For more than 10 years, you worked in national security, including as Chief of Staff of Global Defense, Security, and Justice at Deloitte Consulting. That's a big job, Jason.
Rick, it was, and I tell you, what really prepared me was when I got started in national security in D.C., I started at the very ground level. I was just an analyst in a row full of other analysts who were reading the traffic that was coming in from around the world based on what our intelligence community was picking up about counterterrorism. And so I really saw from the ground level, you know, not just the magnitude of the threats that are out there, but the sausage of policymaking, sometimes that awkward space between policy intent and implementation. And I got a good taste for that that helped me as I continued to sort of move up throughout the national security architecture.
Well, I'm dying to know, did you grow up wanting to be an expert in national security issues? I can just see you saying, gee, Dad, I want to be in national security. Or did you kind of come to this as a coincidence?
You know, I don't have any great story like that from when I was young. I think like a lot of kids, I just wanted to be either an astronaut or a baseball player. But as I got older, I just continually found myself following national security news. And I recognized, right, that after 9/11, there was a generation of men and women who stood up and went and fought for their country. And I was not part of that generation. I was still in college. I didn't go and join the military. It was a number of years later as I matured and I thought, wow, like, we are really responsible for these outcomes. And I just continued to follow foreign policy, and I eventually made the leap and moved to D.C.
Wow. Well, we are lucky that it worked out that way because I think we need people who think like you. Let me ask you a question. We're having all sorts of issues with China, and China's having all sorts of issues with itself right now. There seems to be something missing when it comes to China and the U.S. Do you have a thought on that process?
Yeah, Rick, I do. I think there's a big piece of the narrative missing here. And I really think this is on us here in the United States. And I mean both policymakers, politicians, but also the American people. The conversation we're having about China, I think, is actually too comfortable. You know, I look back on great foreign policy battles of the last century, and we were having these big fights on detente, containment, confrontation, right? And those were at the center of the domestic debate. Whereas right now, there's not as much an appetite to talk about foreign policy. We're getting out of Iraq. We're out of Afghanistan. We're very inward focused. And so what I see in Congress is a consensus that we need to counter China. And that's good that that's a bipartisan consensus. But I'll argue the reason there's that consensus is because we're making easy choices. Our strategy is unclear. It's muddled. And so there are things that we need to do. We need to understand, what are our red lines? Which specific Chinese actions are acceptable? And for the ones that aren't, what specific actions is the United States willing to take? And I'm afraid that we're missing a big chunk of that discussion.
Oh, I agree. And I think part of that is because of the incredible interdependence between China and the U.S. I mean, the number of people they have here going into every industry, not just media and Hollywood, and, you know, they own so many of our large companies. They own so much of our land area. You've got Eric Swalwell, who certainly went a little overboard with a Chinese spy. You've got Mitch McConnell, who's married to a Chinese family. And I think there's so much in terms of relationships that I don't think we know how we can fight an enemy if they are, in fact, our enemy.
You know, Rick, and one of the things I would say there is this is not going to look like the fight against the Soviet Union because we were so economically decoupled from the Soviets. And even if we take those steps here, there's no guarantee that that would limit Chinese behavior. And so there was important testimony this week on the Hill about the many ways that China is infiltrating the United States. So one of those examples is the Confucius Institutes that they've established on college campuses. Mm-hmm. And the other thing a lot of people don't realize is just how prevalent Chinese hacking is. So folks might have seen the headlines from a few weeks ago, and we'll probably talk about those, of a major Chinese hack. But what a lot of people don't know is just in the past few weeks, they went after the Metropolitan Water District in Southern California. So they're testing our defenses, they are finding ways to infiltrate, and then they are influencing, blackmailing, hacking, and otherwise going after people, not just in government, but in academia and in a number of other places. The one thing I do want to make sure I say, Rick, though, is I think that Secretary Chao, Mitch McConnell's wife, has herself served with some distinction. And she deserves praise for that. But the final point I want to make is the scope of what you're talking about. Where and how do we look to counter Chinese influence when we are so intertwined with them? No one has a great answer yet. And that's what I want. When we talk about a pivot to Asia, that's got to be a big part of that discussion.
Absolutely. And we just had a very interesting guest a week or so ago, Roger Garside from England. He's a retired diplomat, and it's his belief that the Chinese will, within the not-too-distant future, become a democratic country rather than a command economy communist party. And that would clear a lot of issues, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that would be one of the great developments, and I mean this without hyperbole, that would be one of the great developments in human history. China is 1/7 of the world population. To think that they all live under a dictatorship, the type maintained by social credit and by force of communist rule, is a human tragedy. To think that they suppress religious activity, Christianity, the fact that there are underground worship and sex. We haven't seen religious persecution of this type, you know, of this scale, in a very long time. They right now are suppressing, obviously, the Uyghur minority with actual concentration camps, and then right other ethnic minorities. So to see China open up in that way would be one of the great advances in the human condition in history. The question becomes, right, what are the rulers who are now have essentially 100 years in power as the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party as a force is now 100 years old. They've gotten much better at maintaining control. And I think what folks don't always realize is that even in the past few years, President Xi has accomplished what I would argue is a regime-type change, where he has really become the personification of government. He's essentially now a king for life, or until he chooses to retire. And what changes when the regime type changes is the type of lies that the regime tells. And I think we saw some of that evidence with COVID, and we see it with some of the other things that China's doing, where they've gotten even bolder in the types of propaganda and lies that they'll put out into the world.
Indeed. Well, they don't tell the straight story ever. It's amazing to listen to their tall tales. I would suggest, if you get a chance, Garside's book called China Coup is quite interesting, and you might find it eye-opening from a guy who was in the mission in Beijing in two tours. So it's kind of interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You've been critical of the U.S. pivot to Asia. What exactly is the U.S. pivot to Asia?
Great question, Rick. So 2011, Obama was ramping down in Afghanistan. General foreign policy consensus, both Republicans and Democrats, was, hey, we're bogged down. You know, we're fighting these wars and these counterterrorism missions. The center of the world economy, the center of the balance of power in the world is shifting to Asia. And so Barack Obama in 2011 announced that the United States would begin a pivot to Asia. And there were actual guideposts associated with that. I'll give you an example, that 60% of our naval presence would be situated in the continent or around the continent, right, in Pacific waters, et cetera, in that theater. And this was the way that we were going to start engaging with the world, was Asia first, Asia-centric. And then that didn't really happen. They didn't really fulfill that promise. And the reason they didn't fulfill that promise is, well, a lot of things happened after 2011. ISIS rose in Iraq. Russia invaded Ukraine, right? And all these sort of aggressive foreign policy things. We intervened in Libya. All of these things happened, and we ended up sort of distracted. And a lot of our partners and allies in Asia at the time were disappointed. Trump continued sort of moving us towards that pivot. And he announced it as an Indo-Pacific region. That was sort of his rebrand. The future is in the Indo-Pacific region. And Congress actually put some money towards that. I think it was called the Asian Reassurance and Investment Act. So that's what the pivot was. And my argument is that we haven't really fulfilled the promise of that strategy. And I'm not convinced that this administration is actually serious about doing so.
Well, it's interesting because I lived in Australia for 23 years, and I can tell you they made the pivot to Asia 30 years ago, and it has proved to be more problematic than they ever thought. So there's a lot of difficulties in making a move like that.
I think you're right, Rick. And one of the things to think about, right, is Australia is one of those key allies, the Philippines, obviously Japan, and obviously Taiwan, you know, but even Vietnam and some of these other countries that we are working with, they have not been reassured by our action. And so when I say I'm critical of the pivot, I'm really critical of it in the sense of I'm asking the foreign policy establishment, where is the pivot? We're out of Afghanistan now. What is the grand plan if we're going to contest Chinese plans for dominance in the region? And I just don't see a lot of evidence of it. One of the things that I wonder is, was this a rhetorical cudgel that we used to pull ourselves out of some of these counterterrorism and other missions around the world? But is there not a follow-through? And let me give an example here. The Secretary of Defense was in, I think, Singapore this week, and he gave a speech and said, hey, we're committed to this region, and we're going to begin this naval cooperation with these different countries, and we'll see different patrols. And that's all the type of thing we want to hear. But what's missing is specifics. Okay, we're out of Afghanistan. which specific men, money, and materiel are we moving, and to where? Which Vietnamese or Filipino fishing trawlers that the Chinese are harassing with their naval ships are we going to protect? If China tries to build more islands in the South China Sea, which are really military bases, will we or will we not intervene? And so I see a disturbing lack of specifics, and what I would argue is a disturbing lack of meat behind what has been branded the pivot to Asia.
Well, my concern, and I agree with you entirely, my concern is that lack of planning is intentional. I see so much of an effort in our country to become partners with China in so many ways that I just don't think we're going to get involved as we should in protecting our allies.
And, you know, I think that there is a bipartisan consensus that we should be involved. And what I'm nervous about is that with neither party asking tough questions of this administration, about what the plans are, that it's really just statecraft as usual. So and that, Rick, I say that to respond to your point, that is, I'm not sure there's actually a will there to take the steps that we would need to counter a country that is growing its influence aggressively. They call it wolf warrior diplomacy. That is a Chinese term used by the leader and propagated by Chinese state media. So the question is, does the United States have an internal resolve? And there's a question that I think the United States politicians and policymakers can almost put back to the American people. Hey, guys, these are the alliances that we've signed up for. These are the security institutions that we are a part of. Is there an internal consensus on behalf of the American people to uphold these treaties? Will we back them with force? So there's an internal discussion that we need to have. And when we have that and establish consensus, we can say, okay, here are our clear red lines of where we will intervene, either on behalf of the United States or behalf of the rules of the international order. And then here are the ones we're not willing to defend, and we expect that there will be, you know, ripple effects of that throughout the world.
Well, here's an interesting correlation or addition to that. It's called Taiwan. Will we? I mean, we are committed by treaty to defend Taiwan, but the term defend can be defined in a number of different ways. Will we start a shooting war or enter a shooting war to defend Taiwan? Or will we destroy China's economy in the flick of a switch, which we can do?
So, Rick, I tell you what, there's another important or there as well. Will we defend Taiwan and all of the havoc that will include? Or will we not, and recognize that the series of international treaties that essentially upholds world peace could unravel immediately? And so right now, there is concern about China moving on Taiwan. This is the highest amount of concern in the past 6 months in probably 20 years. And part of that reason is just there is a sense that America is turning inward under both parties. But part of it was China was ramping up the moves that they made, and the U.S. has responded. We've sent higher-level delegations there than we have in a long time. Our allies have sort of rallied to the idea. Japan even suggested they would potentially be a combatant. So we've taken some steps that, let's say, have backfired on China in the immediate term. But that doesn't change the trend lines that you're talking about. And so what I think the United States can do is we need to be very explicit with China. Here are the circumstances in which we'll intervene. Here are the mechanisms in which we'll intervene. We understand that they have what are called, I think, A2AD, anti-aerial access denial capabilities. The idea is to prevent the U.S. Navy and air support from getting close enough to Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion to make a difference until they're already entrenched there. What we need to do is demonstrate to them that we understand that strategy and we have the capacity to deter it at great cost to them in explicit detail. And the reason I say that is the more detailed we are and the more concrete we can state these things, both in private channels and publicly, that's actually increases the odds that we avoid conflict.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. But let me ask this. If those delineations were made by a personality like Donald Trump, you know darn well he's going to live up to what he says. Is the same true with our current administration?
It is not. And my fear is we are sacrificing a credible deterrence. We have seen Iran attack via armed drone and missiles our forces in Iraq and Syria. They've round three volleys of attacks in the past month that we have not responded to. Russia-based actors have hacked the major pipeline in the East Coast of the United States, as well as some of those other ransomware attacks we're aware of. China has attacked Microsoft Exchange servers that provided the software for many, many companies, academic institutions around the world. And I have seen in none of these cases a sufficient retaliatory response on behalf of this administration. And I'm nervous about what that creates. Not just the fact, Rick, that individually we haven't responded to each of these sufficiently, but the broader degree of instability that creates when people realize that there's sort of this deterrence collapse that took place. And I make the comparison to late in the Obama administration when we saw, all in a few years span, the rise of ISIS in the international terrorist attacks around the world at the same time that Russia was invading Ukraine and planning major cyber attacks against the United States, at the same time that China built these military bases in the middle of the ocean. So that's the type of aggression where borders change, right? Invasions happen when there isn't a belief that the United States will follow up on the things that it says it will do. And so I agree with your point, and I think that we are in a period of risk.
Speaking of conflict, is the U.S. and China conflict unavoidable?
Rick, I don't think it is. And at the same time, I think that without a change in United States policy, we are currently on the likeliest path to a shooting war. Here's what I mean by that. China's changing the rules of the international order. They're using language around the world to describe Chinese behavior. We say bullying or harassment or maritime pressure, or we talk about skirmishes between India and China. These words are insufficient to understand the scope of Chinese aggression. And honestly, U.S. reporters, when they use phrases like this, it doesn't help anybody understand. It obscures the nature of what's happening. And so what the United States needs to do is understand clearly where China's going. We're still playing catch up. And from there, if we set clear red lines, we can avoid conflict. If we continue right now with just the general path of reactionary foreign relations, then conflict is much, much more likely.
Let's talk for a few minutes about our breach of security caused by the latest Chinese virus. You wrote an article titled, "Did Xi Know?" From your perspective, how complicit are the Chinese, and could they have done things differently?
Yeah, Rick, I think that if the Chinese would have done things differently, a lot more people would be alive than are now. And I want to be very precise when I make that point. I'm not suggesting that the highest levels of the Chinese government knew about COVID at any specific time. I'm not suggesting that the regional authorities and those in Wuhan province, as well as at the lab, knew that it was asymptomatic. But what we do know for sure is that as they were learning about the virus, There were time frames via which they obscured what they knew. They failed to cooperate with international authorities. And I want to be, again, very precise about this, they explicitly pointed to other origin theories that prevented a more fulsome investigation as to the genetic diversity of and the cause of this virus. And that cost lives. That cannot be obscured. It did happen. What we need to figure out is, and this is where Z needs to receive pressure and the United States needs to get involved, is if we live in a world in which, let's say, I think it's now 4.2 or 4.3 million people have died from this pandemic, and the world, to include the United States, cannot sufficiently pressure China to be more forthcoming about the investigation of the origins of this pandemic, for what cause will we rally? We've already lost more people in this pandemic in the United States than we have in virtually every U.S. war that we've ever fought. And so that's kind of the sobering way that I try to put this, which is, if we're not willing to stand up here, where are we? And let me give an example of that, Rick. The World Health Organization released a first report. They were finally China finally granted WHO researchers access to some of the facilities in Wuhan, but many months after it would have been relevant. The report came out with virtually nothing new in it. There's now a second report on its way, but again, with very little Chinese cooperation. If we're not willing to commandeer international institutions to actually serve the whole world in an effective capacity, other nations will lose faith in those institutions.
Well, there's a lot of people who lost faith in a lot of institutions, and that's sad. One of the things that I find interesting is China stands up around the world and sells everybody on how error-free and clued in they are on everything. They make no mistakes. Everything that happens is intentional. Well, okay, was the release of the virus intentional? Is that what they're trying to tell us?
You know, Rick, I don't think that we have evidence that it is. And what I want to make sure I say is, it is not outside the realm of possibility that that could have occurred. Each major historical event, let's say the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand to start World War I, was a shock. So that type of shocking event, we should keep in mind that that type of event could happen again. That said, there is not evidence that it was an intentional release. The way that I think about it is a little bit different. China is pursuing a development model where they have essentially said, we're going to grow fast, we're going to grow cheap, we're going to do it on their own internal credit bubbles, as well as by stealing intellectual property from around the world. And one way to think about the lab leak, which I think is the most likely thing that happened, is that this escaped from a lab accidentally, is that it was an industrial accident, that they didn't have sufficient controls. They didn't have sufficient safety protocols because they're prioritizing these other things over building a solid foundation. And so one of the ways that I tell people to think about this is, well before we knew what COVID was, there had been documented concerns by U.S. bureaucrats, U.S. scientists, other country scientists, and China's own CDC on the lack of safety procedures at these labs around China. And so I think it was an accident. It was a negative externality of China's rise that we are still paying the price for now.
Let me add just one little thought. Is it possible that the release was accidental, but what happened after the release was entirely intentional? Here's why, what I'm saying. China prohibited Chinese people from moving from province to province in order to isolate the virus as much as they could. Yet, at the same time, they sent scores, hundreds, thousands of Chinese around the world, and that spread the virus. So it's possible that the release from the lab was entirely accidental. But I have to shake my head when I see what happened afterwards. That looked entirely planned, as if somebody there said, yeah, well, here we are. What are we going to do with it now?
Yeah, you know, Rick, I think there were kind of two things there. One, it was, hey, they're more comfortable taking internal actions in China because they realize that those might not rankle any feathers, right? And they can kind of communicate and keep their people in the dark and just say, hey, this thing's going to change and people aren't going to question it as much. Whereas if they would have changed their protocols and how they deal with international flights, it would have raised people's attention. And we might have realized, wow, they're not being entirely forthcoming yet with what they know. Because remember that at the same time that those things were changing, and again, that wasn't until January of 2020 that they were changing some of those internal travel protocols. That's at the same time they were obscuring the full extent of what they knew to the World Health Organization. And so even if it wasn't the most malicious reading of it, it was that they were trying to prevent international embarrassment and trying to obscure the potential likely origin having come from the lab versus the other theories they were announcing. Here's why I say that, Rick, because I want to take your point on specifically, and because I get it, is they allowed in Wuhan province where the outbreak was, they allowed a bunch of those people to come in for a massive festival of their own citizens. And they also allowed people to travel for some of the holidays that take place in China in January. And that's why I think the answer is a little bit more complex. But I also just want to make one final point here, which is that timeline of their involvement. What we know for sure is that earlier transparency would have allowed progress on sequencing, understanding the genetic diversity of this virus, on tracing where it may have been around the world, and allowed scientists and decision makers a head start that could have saved a number of lives. And there appears to be no accountability for China for that fact.
Yep. I don't think the international court is going to be much of a venue for compensation for people suing China. Although there are some lawsuits going on now.
Yeah, so you know what will be interesting, Rick, is what does that accountability model look like? Because, you know, I'll give you an example. So what I say is, hey, we need to be more aggressive against China. And I get a good question back, which is, well, what does that actually look like in practice? And it's exactly what you're touching upon there. Would the international courts, would other forms of restitution help, both one, for people to recover what they've lost, but two, would they serve as a future deterrent or to put pressure on China? Unclear. I'll give you another example. Right now, there's a concentration camp operating in China, the Uyghur minority. These are actual documented concentration camps. And not that many miles from where that's happening, maybe a few hundred, they're going to host the Olympics next year. So the question is, what are the levers that the United States can pull? Should we participate in the Olympics? How else do we respond in ways that deter or change the calculation of Chinese decision makers? I'll give you an example. We have suffered that attack where they, again, Chinese hackers attacked Microsoft Exchange servers. It's Microsoft's role as a third-party software provider to so many businesses and institutions around the United States. We announced their involvement, that it was specifically was Chinese intelligence was responsible. And at that announcement, we announced zero sanctions, and there is no plan to sanction Chinese leaders, the Chinese intelligence service, or any other entity in China for their involvement. And so without some element of a retaliatory cyber response, we are guaranteeing the continuation of this type of damaging behavior.
Yes. Well, there are three, and I'm admittedly I'm not an expert in this, but one can see three possible responses. One is to harden our systems to prevent these kind of incursions, but I don't think it's possible. As soon as we get smart enough to make a system protected, somebody's going to be smart enough to unprotect it. So I'm not sure that's going to be much value in the future. The second is to respond in kind. So if your bad actors attack us, we can attack your systems too. And the third, of course, is to use a military response. So are there any other options? And how do you move from recognizing which is the appropriate response?
Great question, Rick. First thing, I agree with you. We will do the hardening and the resiliency and all the DHS-focused things, and we should. I'll give you an example. DHS just stood up something called the Joint Cyber Defense Collaborative with industry. Hey, they're going to share best practices. They're looking at policy options for how to help companies better respond to ransomware. But all of that reminds me of the defensive law enforcement first approach of the 90s that failed against asymmetric actors back then, right? If we're talking about hackers or those groups sponsored or harbored by nation states. What we need to do is this. We need to create a doctrine of retaliatory cyber responses. Retaliatory cyber responses. And very often those actions need to be public. So we need to put out a marker to the world that says, if a pipeline in the United States goes down, and when we determine the country of origin, a similar action of some kind will happen in that same critical sector over there. Now, that doesn't mean that we want to shut down some major, you know, public safety element in another country. These are, right, that people are dependent upon. But what it means is we have to figure out tailored responses, not behind the scenes with cyber command doing things in the dark, but specific and publicly knowable cyber actions. I'll give you an example. President Clinton, President Trump, President Bush, President Obama, all of these presidents in the past have used airstrikes, limited airstrikes, to sometimes send a message in response to the activities of our adversaries. President Trump, for example, authorized limited airstrikes in response to serious crossing of a red line as it related to chemical weapons use on the battlefield. We need to start to explore the version of that in the cyber realm and figure out how we can deter those actions. And then if and where that doesn't work, then we start to talk about some real-world military actions too.
Yep. Well, I think we certainly need to be stronger than we are in a lot of manners. Listen,
yep, and Rick, one thing I'll say there to your point is that we need a strength. Demonizing China, which I've seen a lot of Congress people on both sides of the aisle do, is not always helpful. Again, they're 1/7 of the world population. But what we need is for the American people to understand, hey, here are the specific things that China is doing that threaten the international order and the benefits we get from that order. And also here are the specific provocations against the United States that we need a more coherent approach on how to respond to. And I think that both U.S. policymakers and politicians, but also the American people are capable of having a more productive conversation.
Yep. And we need to have the conversation. Sadly, it'll always be away from our eyes. So we don't know when our leaders are actually doing their job. We just hope they are.
It feels like that sometimes, but I tell you, at that lowest level, that congressperson and that senator that you're electing every couple of years, particularly in terms of your legislators, you let them know, hey, we're paying attention to what you guys say. We're paying attention to which experts in DOD or the intelligence community you choose to call for hearings. We're paying attention to our public pronouncements and our summits with China. And I think that you can see a degree of responsiveness on behalf of our legislators that you know, isn't always there, but can be.
Yeah. Good points. Listen, not all security issues are foreign in nature. What are your current views on our domestic security problems? Who are our enemies, and what the heck do we do about it?
Oh, good question. You know, I hesitate to talk internally about enemies. I think that the greater problem that the United States has is we are seeing our political union strain. And when you look at the CDC moratorium that the Biden administration announced in August and some of these other things, they are symptoms of a people that are divided on core governance issues. So let me give you an example. The members of the squad that folks talk about, they were talking about housing as a human right. But we know what our rights are. We have a bill of them, the Bill of Rights. And so the reason I'm going into this detail is I'm suggesting that the United States is actually, these aren't just partisan battles. These are core governance problems that we have a group of people who are committed to essentially what is a European social democracy that could not and should not ever exist here in the United States. And, you know, we're seeing sort of these sweeping waves of populism, and that's on both sides of the aisle. So my fear is that these waves of populism, which were, by the way, well-earned, right, that there's a reason we're in this era of populism, but my fear is that the cost to those, the disorder that we're going to continue to see, is going to be more costly than we realize.
Everything is getting more costly than we want it to be.
Yeah, I feel that way at times, Rick. And one thing I'll say, too, because you asked about that other point about the threats. This administration has recently claimed that domestic terrorism is the greatest security threat to the United States. And I understand there were events of domestic terrorism, many that don't make the news, over the past number of years. But again, this was the exact same security attitude that Democrats had in the 1990s. When they embraced a DOJ and FBI first domestic law enforcement approach and tried to fit it to a range of problems that it does not fit well with, and we paid the consequences for that. So what the American people need to ask very hard is, let's be careful. How does the government intend to use that framework, and could it be used to stifle domestic dissent? There's obviously not a great history there. And two, if we're going to continue to take foreign threats like these major ransomware attacks and apply a DOJ-first law enforcement model, why would we expect the results to be any different than they were when we applied that same model to asymmetric threats like terrorism unsuccessfully in the 1990s?
Yeah, great. It's, well, you know, I hate to say it, but I look at the news. I always watch both sides of the news because I need to understand what's being said. But I don't like being called a domestic terrorist. Yeah, it's not my view of my own self and my part in the world. So I get a little bit perturbed to hear our government say that, you know, a vast bulk of America are domestic terrorists.
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the things that is a struggle, Rick, too, is politicians use this language, and they're not always cognizant of the impacts that it has, right? So I remember when, you know, we saw this word, that increasing use of domestic terrorism. And I remember hearing about the, what was the phrase, deplorables, right? Mm. Or when Obama talked about those folks that cling to their guns and their religion, or even when Mitt Romney talked about the 47% folks, these sort of often hot mic moments that have become cultural touchstones in our ongoing partisan battle. And one of the things we have to keep in mind is how much those hurt. People still remember that. right? I remember somebody who brought up that comment by Mitt Romney like a couple months ago in conversation. That still bothered them. And so I think you're right that when the government, in particular, people in positions of very real power in the federal government use that language, it calls for a humility and a precision and a graciousness that just too often isn't there.
Yep. There's no graciousness left, sadly. Well, when we talk about the domestic problems, we saw things like members of Antifa and BLM moving from state to state to state to cause problems. Same people doing a lot of traveling, a lot of living away from home at a fair amount of expense. Who paid for that? Do we have any idea? Did we try to find out?
You know, Rick, I don't have great insight into that, but let me share two anecdotes. One of those is there are some other groups doing good work out there where they trace the network of funding for a lot of these PACs and advocacy groups that the left uses. And so there are some good maps out there of those networks. A second point, and I think you made this, is we know for sure that the Russians and the Chinese have sought to sow discord within our country. And that is not a suggestion that they were explicitly funding either of those two groups. It is just a fact that we know one of their goals is to increase internal dissent in the United States. The third point that I want to make there, actually, and I want to add a third, is when we see groups like that, and we saw them protesting, not just in the wake of the George Floyd killing, but before then as well. What that ended up sometimes with was legitimate outrage and protest, but at other times, what it really was intimidation of people with right-wing viewpoints, intimidation in the public square, showing up to counter protests and initiate violence. In a sense, one of the two political parties of the United States had a street arm. And that's a shocking thing to think about. But in the latter part of the last decade, that was the case. And so I think people need to take a step back and realize, hey, these are the signs of a straining political union, right, of a federal union. And if we keep concentrating our conflict on an oversized and overpowered federal government, there aren't going to be any winners at the end of the day.
That's the truth. Well, we've reached the end of our hour, Jason. I am very sorry to say that. I could go on forever, it feels. Well, thank you for your time today. And it's been a great hour. And we will do this again. Absolutely. Thanks for all our listeners.